I'm nothing more than that. We're not making decisions or building or constructing policy with these meetings, but we are creating an opportunity for issues to come out so we can discuss them, we can solve problems together. And I love participating in this type of forum. It's good, it allows time and a comfortable environment for people to speak freely with each other. So that said, again, I'm Mitch Nichols, Community Development Director, Clark County.
Vicki Van Zandt, I'm a neighbor of the Ogiers, so interested in the quarry operation.
Katie Jarvis, East Fork Community College.
Nick Edgar, resident on Gabriel Road.
Marie Ogier, East Fork Community Coalition.
Charlie Priscilli, resident in the Yakaldaria.
Gary Ogier, East Fork Community Coalition.
Dick Lewenberg, East Fork.
Marilyn McCall, the Neighborhood Program Coordinator, Clark County.
Christy Mullen, Land Use Review.
Susan Allen, Driver, Land Use Review Manager, Clark County.
Chloe Simmons, I'm a resident of Ariel and immediately adjacent to land, which is being under consideration for a proposal for the quarry by Chilton Square Communities.
Jan Bazala, I work in Community Development, Los Texas, and Mitch.
Postal Hall Operator.
Sean Art, Fresh Prairie resident.
Just still the same one to see the passes.
Bob Schnell, SWCA.
Andrew
Smith, SWCA.
Claudia Frost,
Tyler
County County
Resident.
Winnie
McCullough, Winnie Vermont. Hunter
Decker, Clark County Forester.
Shelly Warren, Clark County Resident.
Jake
Graham, with Clark County
State. Thank you very much. Okay, with that, to get started, it's one of the things I'd like to do is quickly review the comments that we received in between the last meeting and now, just kind of summarize the type of comments that we received. So, and this is in addition to the survey. So, generally for the Yakult Quarry, we did receive a number of comments that were not completed, so we weren't actually able to get that information. We did get the emails, however. So we'll try and reach back out to those folks for clarification to get an idea of what it was they were concerned with or what they wanted to communicate. Generally, we've had five comments that were concerned directly with truck traffic and the number of trips. We had three comments that mentioned groundwater and environmental issues, including noise. We had one that directly mentioned habitat, fish habitat in particular. We had five messages that were in support of the quarry operations. That didn't, and even though they specifically mentioned that they were in support of the quarry operations, they recognized in two cases they recognized that there were impacts, and they felt that the operators were doing a good job to address those things from their perspective as long. I was not speaking for a group of people. We also did a survey, and before we, I asked Marilee to give us an hour on that, what I'd like to do is talk about some of the outreach we did and the intent of the survey, because there was a bit of confusion out there, and I own that. What we should have done is preface the survey and speak very specifically about the intent. And the intent, as directed by the forum, the conversation in the forum, is to reach out specifically to individuals that live in and around these surface mining operations, and in particular the Yakult operations, since that's the most prevalent target we have right now as far as dealing with the bringing them into the forum process to have and address the issues there. We reached out to include as many other voices that were impacted as possible, and that was the only intent of the survey as far as outreach. It wasn't a community-wide or county-wide survey that looked at the mining operation or surface mining issues overall. We just wanted to hear from people that were not included in the meetings and didn't have an opportunity to get here, because there was feedback in the forum that, hey, you know, there's the first one, the meeting time date was a challenge for people to get to. It was in the afternoon. There were a lot of people that couldn't leave work or couldn't travel because they had to pick up their kids and so forth. So this was a good way for us to reach out to those folks and say, hey, we'd love to hear from you, so we can get some feedback. There was some very, very important aspects of the misunderstanding that are important for us to recognize. Industry itself felt alienated with the survey. They respectfully reached out to us and said, hey, we feel that this survey has not been inclusive. It has been targeted, it's been so focused that it's been exclusive, and it appears to be intentionally exclusive. That was not our intent. We just only really wanted to hear from this group of people that were participating and impacted by the Echo Mountain Quarry. We did hear from people outside the quarry and in relation to other quarry operations, so, and Mary Lee will cover that when she explains the survey results. When we do this again for other quarries, we'll be very, very good about explaining the intent up front, but in deference to the issues raised by the industry and the supporters of the industry, it's essential for us to be fair. And to be fair, we should also reach out to the community or to the folks that are beneficiaries of the industry and see what their intake, you know, and get their feedback as well. I think that's a fair thing for us to do, but I'd like the guidance and support of the forum in that. It's not something that we're going to demand. It's something that we've open for discussion. So with that, Merrill, if you could be so kind as to run us through the survey results, that would be great.
I went ahead and passed out hard copies so that you can follow along, so I'm going to explain a couple of the things, and I'm going to stand because it reminds me to speak louder. What I prepared kind of goes over again some of what Mitch said, but the background of this is last year, because of neighborhood concerns, it came to my office. Neighbors were concerned about voicing their opinion on fireworks. Previously, when I had done surveys when I worked in community planning, the highest number of results that we had ever received was 600. With the tool of using Nextdoor and broadcasting the survey out through Nextdoor, we landed up with over 7,000 responses regarding the fireworks, which was phenomenal. Because of the high number of the responses and the obvious public popularity of the voicing concerns through this method, we discussed creating and releasing a survey for the residents to prioritize their issues on quarries. Our process involved receiving a list of concerns at the first advisory forum, and then we compiled the list and created a survey, which we first reviewed internally and then extended a public invitation to weigh in on those concerns. The three main purposes were to broaden the public access, as Mitch stated, so that people could voice public concerns regarding the various quarries that currently have the conditional use permits. We also wanted to clarify the different residents' priority of public concerns at the specific quarry sites. And then, finally, we wanted to assist in setting those priorities for scheduling these meetings so that we could address the highest concerns of the public first. It helps us manage our staff and our time better and your time better. None of the report data has been downloaded into Excel or altered in any manner. The report is basically a compilation of screenshots of the actual results of the survey from the SurveyMonkey site. The report includes, if you look at the first page, it'll show side-by-side overall results, and then it compares them to the area-specific Yakult Mountain Quarry results. The software requires a manual entry request to show only results from each quarry, and there has not been staff time available to compile the other location results at this time. And I apologize for that. It's these guys' fault. I'm a staff of one in the neighborhood program, and I have been reduced, my hours have been reduced, and so I'm getting to it as quickly as I can. I will make sure that the results for each location are processed prior to each quarry's first advisory forum meeting. The report that you have a copy of is 5 pages long, and it uses pie graphs, so there's a visual to display the different percentages of concern between the overall respondents and the residents that marked Yakult Mountain Quarry as their quarry of concern. The last page, I feel like, needs a little bit of explanation. It has the prioritization of concerns for the overall respondents and the Yakult Mountain Quarry residents. The percentages and the votes under the numbers 1 through 6 show the number of votes for that particular issue as number 1 priority, number 2 priority, etc. The concerns are sorted in order of their weighted score from the highest concern to the least concern. So what you're seeing on that is issue number 1 through 6 for overall and then issue number 1 through 6 for Yakult Mountain. The weighted score is to the far right. You can see those there, 3.9, 4.5. And although in the two surveys, the residents have ranked 1 through 6 in the same order, the scores are not necessarily aligned. The example is the truck route score. The overall survey rate is 3.98, but Yakult Mountain residents scored it higher at 4.20. That was a higher concern of them.
I don't understand the score. I must really be slow. How did you get 4.5?
That's a weighted score of that the system sets for me, and it's saying that there's that's like a percentage or the number of, it's taking all of these averages of who voted for number one, who voted for number two, and it's a crosstab comparison. Because you're showing the issues, and then there's who voted for number one, who voted for number two, who voted for number three, and then this is just an automatic ranking. I don't know what that number means specifically, other than that it's when I did this and took all of these percentages, I came out with the same order. So I compared all of these percentages and went, okay, who voted number one? Yes, environmental protection was number one. On number two, I went all the way down, and blasting noise and vibration was 23.06, which was a high score. And it wound up being number three, because if you go all of the percentage of what people voted, it actually wound up lower on the scores than the truck routes. Does that make sense?
I'll work on it.
Okay. Yeah, it took me a while to figure out why it did it this way, but I crunched a whole bunch of the numbers of going, okay, why did you do it this way? And if you look at the adding up the numbers, it's an average, and it does work out. But the intent of the prioritization question, I got a lot of emails to me. There were several people upset because they said, well, all of these are important. Why are you making us vote number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6? And our intent wasn't to force anyone to say, okay, this is less important. Our intent was, we have to decide what's going to come first on the meetings. And so what do you want to hear about the most? And we probably should have described that better, that this isn't the most important thing to you, but we want to know what we're going to address first, second, third, fourth, and fifth. And so were there any more questions on it? I'm not a data cruncher. I'm not a data analyst. I put the questions into this software system, and then it spits out what the results are for me, and I'm presenting them, and I explain it the best that I can. I apologize that I'm not more scientific in my explanation.
One of the other things that I wanted to cover is we did receive a number of public information requests demanding that the interim results of the survey be provided to the public prior to closing of the survey. And the reason we don't release those, first, they're in draft form, and second, because we don't want to corrupt the survey itself by releasing information that may affect how somebody decides to prioritize something if they see their issue is not rising to the level they hope for. This is the same practice, best practice used in voting. So when you go to the polls and you vote, the votes are not actually, that information is not provided to anyone until after the polls are closed and voting is finished. So there is no longer anyone that can be influenced by a statement made by publication of results or partial results that may influence the outcome of the vote. This is a best practice in surveys and voting that's utilized nationwide. We certainly appreciate the fact that there was some immediate response to, we want to see whatever it is the county is doing with these results beforehand. But the Public Information Act does give us the ability to withhold draft results from the work that we're doing to ensure that we don't inadvertently or intentionally affect the outcome. That's by design, it's by intent. So I wanted to clarify that. We're doing our best to respond to all the information requests we receive. there were a substantial amount, and they were, I think, acting without complete understanding of how the process works. So, again, what we'll do is, if we go out with another survey, we will be very clear up front in the publication of the survey, in the recitals, that we're not going to be releasing draft information, partial information, or preliminary information about the survey results. I just wanted to get that on the discussion.
And I do have, I think I've only got 10 copies because it's 17 pages, but the overall results are a little, the numbers are really small on that report. So I did print out what SurveyMonkey gave me for the overall results that has bigger numbers on it so that it's easier to read. This is not Yakult Mountain or Livingston Mountain or any of the other separate ones, but this is the overall results. And so
there,
all said,
there's nothing there that isn't here. It's
there's
just
nothing
printed
here.
Bigger.
It's just printed bigger. Absolutely. But I'll put it back there in case anyone wants that information.
Now that the survey is over, this is public now.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
it's actually posted on the website now.
So what are we going to do with the survey results? It's pretty obvious that environment is at the top of the list for Yakult Mountain. And it just so happens that we've had some good luck reaching out to the Clean Air Authority and the DNR, to their surface mining coordinator, to come and join the forum next time we meet. So we're trying to coordinate that. We'll release the date of that meeting once we have their availability nailed down. So we're taking the direction given to us through the survey and through your feedback, emails and calls and visits. Thank you all for that. It's been really helpful in giving us direction that we need to move forward. So our next meeting will be focused on the environmental impact specifically. And what I'd like to do between now and the time we set that date is to get some feedback from forum attendees and others about the specific issues so we can set these folks up for success with their presentations and they can address the specific issues that we'd like to have them address, that you would like to have them address.
Who's coming again?
DNR, Department of Natural Resources, their surface mining manager, program manager, is going to be joining us. And, from, I do not know who will be joining us from the Clean Air Authority.
Is that county or state?
It would be Southwestern Washington Clean Air Authority, and they provide a regional service for us for a regional program.
And
back to the survey, are there results on the other 646 people that voted on this? What areas of concern they have?
Yes, as I said, I have to go into that system and I have to say, give me only the results from this area,
right.
And then I have to cut it and paste it into a document, and I'm going as long as I can and actually get stock reserves being here.
But eventually we might be able to see the results of the other five.
Should be within the next 2 weeks.
Okay, absolutely.
Is the Clean Air Authority the same as the Clean Air Agency?
I think so,
but if there is a state Clean Air Agency, I think that's the Department of Ecology operates those folks and does those. The Western region would be our Southwestern region. The Department of Ecology would have that responsibility. I used to deal with the Eastern Region office in Spokane when I dealt with emission particulate and all that kind of stuff in Pasco. So there is a state body that operates out of the Department of Ecology that I'm aware of. These won't be them. No. These folks may work in concert with them. So I'd like to know more about how their operation is set up.
And you're interested in feedback on what we'd like to hear them address in there when they do come here,
the
right?
The specifics, right, yeah. And so we've got a lot of data and information, but again, since we know they're coming, if there are issues that we'd like to get around, from a consensus perspective, raising our hands, finding out what it is we'd really like to have them talk about. We'll only have an hour and a half by construct, but if we need to go longer, we can find that out in advance. We'll give them at least equal time, maybe an hour apiece, to do their presentations.
Mitch, are you asking for that to come in the form of an email at a later date, or are you soliciting that input
I'm
now?
I'm soliciting tonight just to let you know that we're needing it, but we would appreciate it in the form of emails so we can kind of call it and count. Yes.
Sorry, for the environmental, are you limiting it to like the dust, air quality, and groundwater?
No.
Because some of the survey items call out like blasting separately.
Yeah, there's all sorts of
landslides separately. Yeah, those are, in my mind, those are all environmental also.
They are. So it's inclusive of everything.
Everything. Okay.
And not the slide areas, the seepage into groundwater and so forth. All those things are inclusive. Yeah, we're not trying to limit it in any way, shape, or form.
Or and break
that's
it
the quarry
into.
Email. The quarry email.
Yes, yes. Yes, respond to the quarry email, please. Yes.
Thanks, Mitch. I'm keenly interested in learning about the reclamation requirements and also learning a little bit about Stordal's history in restoring productive forests as a conditional use permit coal score. I'm dubious, knowing that mountain and the land, that a productive forest can necessarily be regenerated. Having spent 40 years studying forest regeneration in extremely disturbed environments.
All right. Mr. Stordal is here tonight. Perhaps in a little bit, we're going to focus on the operation, but I appreciate your feedback. Thank you. That said, moving along, if there's no more questions, okay, great.
I'm going to excuse myself and head home and ice my wrist back up again.
Thank you very much.
Anything that is addressed to this topic should just go to Mitch or the Corey's email, and if it involves me, he'll send it to me so that I can make sure that I get answers to your questions.
Thank you.
All right. Bo, would you like to join us?
Sure.
Give us an outline of the mining operations.
So, I was prepared to discuss how we arrive at the demand that we supply. Is that what you're looking for?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So, can I just stay put where I'm at, or what do you
think? Yeah, we've got the microphones up here. Help us record it so we can take notes. And so you may have to really speak up out there.
All right.
Here,
let's
the face to all of the audience.
Thanks.
Yep. All right.
Plus those of us that are deaf, the closer you get, the better we hear.
Gotcha.
Okay. So this is something I can submit, I guess, the website, but I have a list. I've got a customer list here that rely on each of our quarries, and then what I did was I printed off a list specific to Mountaintop of jobs that we have bid, been awarded, and have been supplying in the last 12 calendar months. And this becomes, whether it's City of La Center, City of Washougal, Clark County, WashDOT, private sector. Basically, it all starts once the property owner obtains a permit. And that can be from any municipality. Once the permit's obtained, a request for proposal goes out to the general contractor, which usually is my customers. They solicit a rock bid from rock suppliers, builders, subcontractors for pipe. Lowest bidder gets the job, and there lies the demand of that project. So these jobs are bid 2, 3, 6 months in advance, sometimes 2 years in advance. So we have a collective grasp of how much rock is committed to the industry on an ongoing basis. And it fluctuates by season, but for the last 2, 3 years it's been at peak demand yearly. So it'd be easier to look at rather than me explain, but we've got 75 different jobs with customer listings and project location and 3 pages on each. So we're talking 225 jobs in the last year that can take anywhere from 10,000 ton to 100,000 ton on each project. different products included. So that's where the demand comes from. It doesn't come from my eagerness to put more trucks on the road. It's just simply supplying a demand that's there and has been forecasted out for a period of 6 months to a year, ongoing.
Does your list show the location of where the gravel is delivered?
It has a job name.
A job name?
Yeah, the name of the job.
And that sometimes describes the area?
For instance, I'll go down the list here. We've got Clark County Fire, Whipple Creek Subdivision, 88th Street Storage, Richfield High School, Ghost Hawk Subdivision. It's the name of the job that we are supplying.
Did you say there were 275 in the last year? Was that your
roughly
number or something like that?
Yeah, roughly.
225. Okay.
Yeah, I'm estimating we got 75 on each one, and I have three pages, so okay. 225.
Do you have a feel for between bid and delivery what the range is?
Range of what?
A time.
2, 3, 6 months, sometimes a year.
So it's all over.
But it's constant. So we're always forecasting out and determining what the demand's going to be at a particular time of year.
Do you ever have to turn down a job or push them out calendar-wise?
Yep. Yeah. Just based on restrictions, load counts, and that type of stuff.
So what type of things in the industry interrupt your delivery flow?
Load counts, hours of operation, it's all things that we factor on can we commit to this job and satisfy our customer. You know, we talk them at bid time of what do you expect for production daily or weekly, and then we either commit or can't commit at that point based on restrictions on us.
Weather also, right? Weather can be a big
yeah
factor.
Weather can shut the roads down, yeah, and it happens about every year.
Do you find yourself doing more stockpiling in the winter months and all seasons when they're not?
The last 2-3 years, no, not really.
It's just blowing right through.
Yeah. The only thing that shut down Mountaintop, for instance, was the freeze-thaw restrictions, and which is just as well for me. We don't want to be driving when the roads are slick and snow on them.
Let's say you said Clark Fire. I mean, for sure that is, but it doesn't matter.
Clark County Fire District.
Okay, when they ask for a bid, there's presumably a quantity. I don't know if that's a fixed quantity or a plus or minus sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But what other kind of things they ask for? We're going to want 2 truckloads a day for 100 days in a row, I made that up, obviously. But, I mean, what other kinds of things do you have to deal with in scheduling them?
Well, as a contractor, they have to put the bid together to have the most efficient price as possible, or they don't get the work. So factors on start time, end date. Sometimes when a job goes out to bid, it's required to be done in 80 calendar days starting July 1st. Not all jobs are the same. The private sector is a little bit more forgiving because it's not public funds that are funding the project. Oftentimes a contractor could say, look, I can give you a better price if we can do this job in the wintertime because I'll have the manpower to sufficiently finish the project. So not all jobs is the same, but for Clark County, if we're on the subject, they'll put the job out and it's a predetermined quantity on what it will take to complete that project. At that time, as me as a rock supplier, I will only give out bids for the rock item. And it's a predetermined plus or minus 5-10% based on who's estimating the project. And then in the back of my mind, I know that I've committed to this job. We're the low bidder. We need to supply this project between the months of July and August, and it's 15,000 ton of rock.
Are there penalty clauses?
For the contractor, if it's not done in the right amount of time, there's liquidated damages.
He doesn't push that down to you?
No.
You say there are bids. Who is your direct competition?
There's competition everywhere, but directly in Clark County, I would say Cadman.
Cadman?
Cadman, C-A-D-M-A-N.
Cowlitz County, there's Sorensen Trucking, there's El Rock, and they compete into Clark County as well. There's barge material coming in off the river. There's competition everywhere.
So what do you market your product? Is it, I mean, is your
state spec?
State spec.
Yeah.
So it's a higher quality.
Higher quality. It's a if any municipal job requests a quote for aggregate, it has to meet a certain standard. And pits are tested annually and sometimes every 5 years, depending on which product you're trying to get in qualification for, to stay in spec, and that is required on a public works project.
So does that eliminate some of your competition on some bids?
Some.
Yeah.
But in the private sector, no.
Well, I liked your question, Dave, specific to the the operational impact aspects of this. And I'm thinking about the way the CEPs are written. And if we looked at your operational needs, and in particular, I'm looking at max trips, where that provision in the CEP talks about additional trips. Is that because of this dynamic, your operational dynamic, where you've got certain amounts of peak delivery?
Are you talking like specific at Livingston? There's the clause of peak operations.
Right.
And to be honest, that was a pretty arbitrary number that was used at that time. The time the CUP was written, I think the applicant, being the county at the time, conferred with a neighboring quarry and said, "What's your typical sales look like in a day?" And back during that time, it was we sell around 70 loads a day, and during peak operations when we're busy, we'll double that. And that's the way it was written in the CUP. Well, 10 years later, when there's four or five fewer rock pits, that increased demand now goes to a different location. Now goes to a different location where normal isn't 70 anymore. Normal is 150. And peak is 300 now versus what it was 10 years ago. And during the time that the CUP was written with Clark County, that was when 2008, 2009 was around, and you were lucky to sell 70 loads a day, because there was nobody buying rock from you. There was no demand for it. So it's an arbitrary number that's used at the time of the application. I think it's highly flawed, especially when you take into account that when a pit dries up and there's no longer a resource left, those load counts that were attributed to that location dry up with it. They're not redistributed throughout the county where it can meet the demand of the county growth. So the growth is expanding, the demand is expanding, but the supply continues to dwindle and dwindle and dwindle. Not just the supply, but the availability to move that supply to that increasing demand. There's a balancing act that isn't happening. The demand's going up, but the supply is being restricted every turn.
Sure. So where I see the conflicts is in the communities and the impacts on the roads and during school and all those things. If you look at how you have to deliver, when you have to deliver, and the impacts, if you look at the way the CUP is set up, it seems to spread out your delivery over a longer range of time. And I'm wondering if there's some way to find a balance, like you observed, where we could use the CUP as a vehicle to manage the trips, so there was less concentration of trips around school hours, bus hours. There was a higher concentration of trips during periods of time when people were, schools were out for the summer, that kind of stuff.
Well, and any contractor will tell you that they don't start when the school buses stop. I mean, they want rock on their job. Once they get their permit and they start the job, the first thing they want is a load of rock. That's the first thing to hit any job in the county. And they don't wait until 8:30, 9 o'clock to get a load of rock. And it's like Livingston, for example. You've got a 7:30, 8 o'clock start time. So you can't load until 8. You don't hit the job site until 9, 9:30 in the morning. And contractors show up at sunrise, and it's 6 a.m., and they're waiting 3.5 hours for their first load of rock. They've got a whole crew of people waiting on this load of rock to show up, multiple loads of rock to show up, and equipment to spread it around and do the grading. And it's a challenge for contractors. And I wish that there were more here to explain the hardships that they feel from the restrictions put on the supply.
There's a good representative of those folks right here. So we have Southwestern Contractors Association.
Yep.
Clarification, the data you have, is that for all your pits? Or
this is Mountaintop specifically, the one we're talking about here tonight.
Okay.
And that includes both customers in Washington and Oregon?
Yeah, and I know I'd like to put this thing to bed, but I've heard some wild accusations that 50-60% of the Mountaintop product goes into Oregon. We're talking less than 2% of overall volume leaves Washington State and goes into Oregon.
But how about Klickitat, Cowlitz, Lewis, and Skamania counties? Do any rock go to those counties?
If rock leaves Clark County out of Mountaintop, the furthest north it goes is Woodland, and it's right on the border of the county. It's kind of right between the market from our pits in Cowlitz County and Mountaintop. So it's all a matter of how much trucking it takes to get to the job, and that's where the real cost comes from, is transportation. So Woodland is about where the markets meet each other.
But how about to the east and west?
West, got the Columbia River there. East, we don't go into Skamania County, very rarely. Occasionally we'll go up the Forest Service roads, up Forest Road 90 and hit the 25, and we'll end up in Carson area, but rarely. And that would be included in that less than 2% that leaves that.
So, Bo, I had a question regarding, you were saying that it's really high-quality rock that you're mining for aggregate purposes anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, how many feet have you mined down from the former summit at this point? So what's the bottom of your pit relative to the top?
The pit floor now versus when it started?
Yeah.
I'd say right now we're at elevation 1650, I would say.
Started
about 1800.
Yeah. So has the petrology changed as mining moves down into the mountain? Has the rock chemistry changed? I mean, one would think that would be constant. I mean, that's a pluton.
It appears constant, and it's tested annually for, I'll give you a brief range of what WashDOT tests for. You've got LA wear, degradation, specific gravity, absorption, and that's basically the gist of it.
What was the first one?
LA wear. They determine it's a cycle test. They put it in a tumbling machine, and they determine how much loss there is after X amount of revolutions. If it's low quality, it's going to break apart, and it won't meet standards.
Right. Specific gravity would be the one variable that would be likely to change the function of mining rattled off. Although I'm sure contractors and operators like yourself don't like to think in these terms, but what a wonderful scenario to think to let supply of rock regulate the growth of Clark County. For really that low on rock, well, maybe that should curtail the number of building permits.
You'd have to talk to the county about that.
But I think it's a fair argument.
Well, and there's a lot of people in this county that rely on growth to feed their families. And it's not just isolated to the people in this room. I mean, there's thousands upon thousands of families that rely on the construction industry that would disagree with you.
And that relied on the timber industry and relied on the fisheries industry.
Sure.
This is not new to humanity.
Sure.
These things happen.
Yeah.
Industries rise and they fall.
But the supply of rock to determine growth in a county, eventually it will. You know, if it becomes less desirable to build in the county because of the cost of building, then growth will slow down and it will move to a more desirable location. And that's where it starts with the supply, cost of building.
Have you looked at barging? Because there are some.
Have I looked at it? I've seen the cost of it.
Because there's a lot of supply.
And if you're talking 100,000 ton project and an increase of $10 a ton on that project, that's a lot less desirable than it used to be, buying it off the river. So yeah, I mean, eventually that could be the way that we buy rock in Clark County, but it's not desirable, and it wouldn't be desirable for people to come here and build.
But there
so growth would slow down.
There is a huge supply of river from the Missoula floods.
Yeah.
You know, whether
it could make its way down here.
Yeah.
Sure.
Because there's some of that going on now. So
is that the solution to it? It might be.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's a very good solution, and I know everyone in here disagrees.
Economics change very rapidly.
But you talk about a carbon footprint. Just because it's coming off the river, you still have to get it to the job. There's still trucking. There's still people that are affected by the trucking industry getting it from the river to the job site. Mm-hmm. It just becomes someone else's problem, not your problem.
There's a lot of work being done in this area regarding sustainable roads. And literally every aspect of community development is affected by the economy and the health of the economy. And when you look at sustainable growth as a measurement of your success in building healthy communities, you also have to consider the jobs. You have to consider the economic impact of the industry in that community. What is it doing to ensure that we have access to all the things and all the amenities that we need to live happy, healthy lives, to have good jobs that help us thrive in this economy? And as the cost of living has gone up over the past decade, and this is just my observation from a community development perspective, it has become harder and harder and harder for people to get started. They're starting much later in life than I recollect. When I first even thought about buying a home in the 1980s, interest rates were 12%, which you could buy a home for $65,000. And that was a nice three-bedroom home in a fairly, nice suburb. Those things, those dynamics really do influence our ability to manage sustainable growth as a measurement of our success as a community. And I think the thing I struggle with most is the density. The density and the way we're packing people into communities, and there's not a lot of ancillary amenities to deal with the impacts of that, such as road widening and street widening and those things. A lot of those things are being left behind in the process. So this conversation is really important for us as a community, but it's also important for us as a department, because ultimately we are charged with managing the permitting activity in the community and ensuring that we're doing our level best to ensure the regulations that are established are followed, and that if there is an opportunity for us to clear something up, to improve something, that we have a way of doing that, and we have a way of doing it efficiently and quickly. And that hasn't been the case in the past. I think we've kind of inured ourselves to the way the process always operates, and it's time now for us to look at things differently. That's why we're here.
And without wishing to, understand what Bo said, but the issue is, I'm not sure what your definition or anybody's definition of sustainable growth is, but you get some trade-offs here. And I think most of us who are sitting in this room, we're not anti-growth, we're not anti-stored all even necessarily, but we think the trade-offs that have been made historically in our community aren't working for us particularly well right now. And it's that trade-off aspect as opposed, it's not a binary, win, lose, shut them down kind of a thing, but those trade-offs. And I think the community, and that's why, we're sitting here perhaps, but that, if it makes it a little bit tougher on the builder because of the rock, but it does something for the parents of the school, elementary school kids who's waiting for his bus, I think there's got to be a place we can get pretty comfortable with that.
It doesn't stop the builder, though, Dick. It gets passed on to the consumer, and that's where the viability and affordability of building comes from.
Right, understand that. But, the world's full of stuff that does that. You want low-cost housing, throw out zoning totally. That'll bring the cost down. And I'm not, it's again, the trade-off kind of issue. And part of the problem, housing's too expensive. They're talking about 21% raise and whatever the hell it was, Clark County homelessness, because rents are too high. So
Clark County can't alone depend on being a bedroom community for forever. We've got to start developing our own higher paying jobs, because you'll reach a tipping point where there's no point in building additional houses because there's no jobs in Portland. there's got to be a rebalancing or a change in the overall economy of the Clark County itself if we're going to really thrive and grow. Otherwise, we'll get that tipping point and things will change. It's happened in other cities.
Do we know what how much rock cost there is in a typical new house? Like, if you build a $300,000 house, how much of that is rock?
That's a great question.
There's a. It's more than you think when you talk about the concrete and the asphalt driveways, and you factor in everything that rock is necessary for. It's a larger number than you think, and in fact, DNR and USGS per capita estimates that each resident of a county consumes, it was in the study, I think it's 7.5 to 10.5 cubic yards of rock per year, per individual. So if you talk about 500,000 people in the county, that's 3.5 to 4 million ton of rock per year. That's about right. That's a lot.
And just to add, we are doing an independent study on this very subject of how much tonnage is needed for a house, a hospital, you know, the roadways, et cetera. And as soon as we're done with that, we can send it to you, Mitch. And
that would be great. Any type of information like that's helpful. Especially in this discussion. We're here to solve problems. We're here to put this stuff out there and take a look at solutions that maybe we haven't thought of before. This is our opportunity to kind of lay some groundwork for the next couple of decades. And if we get this right, I mean, Clark County becomes the high functioning county that we can be, inclusive of our mining operations and our very, very happy residents, we will have done quite a job. We will have done quite a bit of work, and it's here and now that we have to do that. So anything we can do to communicate with each other and support our not only our communities and quality of life in the community, but also quality of jobs and industry is a delicate balancing act, but I think it's one we can try and get our heads around here.
Thank you for that. And I do think that, and my guess is the county has these that are well established, but Mitch, when you brought up the notion of sustainable growth, I'm just curious about the evaluation criteria and metrics that are being used to assess sustainable growth and the quality of that. And so it seems to me that that's paramount to get those out front. So in the long run, you know, ultimately we all hit what we aim for, and so you better have a target, right? And so this is what it would take to achieve this.
I'm inclined to reach out to our regional economic development folks to see what if they're doing that kind of work, if they're collaborating with our community resources folks to have that kind of study done.
Yeah, and including non-intrinsic type values. It's imperative that those be considered.
Yeah.
I'm kind of new to this issue. a neighbor about 2 miles away from the top quarry. And what I understand about Livingston is that has dramatically increased the number of loads that come out of the mountaintop quarry. Is that accurate?
I would say it hasn't been felt yet, but it has increased.
It hasn't been felt
to the extent that it will, simply because we're not in the busy season of the construction industry. That's in the summertime. So Livingston had a stop work order put on it in January,
and
it's May now, and the busy season's coming. So naturally, it's going to increase. I mean,
is that within your allocation according to your team?
Yeah.
you can increase more than
we can increase more than we're doing now because we're not at capacity right now.
Okay. My biggest concern is about what gets fluffed up when you blast and the dust that moves around.
Right.
So, seeing photographs, dust clouds that last for over 5 minutes, and I've seen the dust that comes out of uncovered trucks. And apparently it's pretty nasty stuff that's not good for lungs. So that is my biggest concern, and it seems to be consistent with what your survey.
I think the suggestion that apparently it's not very good stuff comes from a study that isn't necessarily related to the operations that we do. I think that's fair to admit.
I don't know if it's fair to admit.
I don't think it's fair to say that it's pretty nasty stuff that comes out of there. Based on a sample that was taken from somebody's kitchen counter. I don't think that's fair to suggest that there's a correlation between the two.
Well, how about testing what your rock is and what the dust is right out of your quarry?
This is why we're going to have the Clean Air Authority and the...
Are they going to test?
I don't know. I hope so.
Well, I think there's been... I know you've reached out to Southwest Clean Air, and I have too. There's nothing that would satisfy me more than getting out in front of accusations like that. The problem is there isn't a standard. There isn't an accepted testing method to determine concentration of certain asbestos-related materials.
Don't you want to know what's in it?
Well, and I don't think the results would show you what's in it and to what harm that the ability that it could have on the public. Because there is no standard to it. And that's the issue that Southwest Clean Air has, which I'm sure they'll explain. But if there isn't a standard, there isn't a limitation on safe levels and unacceptable levels, like there is for thousands upon thousands of elements that can be sampled for in aggregate today.
Do we know for sure there is no standard or concentration?
Yes.
Mitch?
Yes.
The studies that were submitted to the website, are those available to people? All the studies about Orionite, Mordenite, Silica, that were all mailed, that were all emailed since the last meeting?
Yeah, this.
Are those available?
Yeah, not yet. Some of these pictures are really blurry, and they don't transfer well, so I was kind of actively going to reach back.
But the studies themselves,
the studies themselves we can do, but it helps to have the supporting information, and we don't want to just put a partial piece of information that we received out there. That's not fair to the person that sent it to us. We want to make sure we have everything that we post. So when we post it, everything goes versus just a piece of it that leaves people asking questions.
So
we're not the ones that can answer the questions.
So all that information's kind of been sitting there for a month?
Well, it has, but it's we have a lot of work to do.
Okay.
So my apologies for not getting back to you quicker on that, but it really is imperative to get it right.
They're pretty easy to find by Googling.
What would be helpful, though, is to have a bona fide regulator in here who does those studies and does respond to those types of complaints throughout our state, here to talk to us all about what the impacts are, what they can and can't do, what is reasonable, what is not reasonable, what to expect, what not to expect, to get the facts. We really do need to get the facts. And I think to both your points, there are unknowns. We can't answer questions right now because we don't have that information. And it's not unknown to us at this moment, but it's unknown to me. And because I am not a geologist. I am not an air sampling expert. I'm not a geotech. So I have not studied those things. And I'd be loath to give any information or speculation as to what is or isn't correct about air sampling or air quality associated with mining operations. I can tell you that coal has been mined in this country for centuries. and it is a known hazard to people that work in that industry, yet that industry continues to be viable in our country. And so if you look at just that alone and then say, well, gravel, open surface mining of gravel or rock doesn't rise to that level, but does rise to some level, well, what is it? What are the facts associated with that?
Yeah, but you, you know, there's a cart and horse issue here, too. If you knew what the heck was in the rock and in the dust, absent any, you know, God-given, certified, whatever they want, sort of standard, at least you know what the heck you're dealing with and you know where to look.
Right.
To say we don't have verifiable limits and justifiable standards when you don't even know what it is, the material you're talking about,
right.
You can't know that there aren't standards because you don't know what you got.
The problem is there isn't enough data in the United States to set a standard, or there would be a standard. So the study
that you're referring to,
they were done in North Dakota, but the main study that had
Turkey.
In Turkey, an Eastern European country, that's the one that you referred to.
Which is a controlled study.
It had a 40% mortality rate, and that's a real study. The problem is the concentration levels that they were exposed to come nowhere near the concentration levels that we have the ability to be exposed to.
How do we know that?
Because there was
some of the
study
people
done,
were mortality rate gravel
done,
road.
And they found arenite in the United States, but it was in sedimentary basin-type formations.
There's maps of it.
Yeah, so I've seen them.
There's still
and I've looked
it.
For the correlation, and what do these dots have in common?
But, Bo, how do you know the concentrations of these particulates in the atmosphere at any one time? I find that hard to believe.
Well, I'm drawing a line between the Turkish study and the study and the correlation between rock dust coming from a quarry in Yakult. And
if
you look at the map,
known volcanic area.
But no one knows the concentration, right? That's clear, right?
Sure.
No one knows the
sure. But it's just like, for instance, arsenic. Arsenic has the potential to be deadly.
Let's find out.
Okay. Well,
it's one of the facts that we keep talking
about. The point
about.
Is that anything can be deadly with the right concentration levels.
Yeah.
Arsenic is found in rock.
So
and there are acceptable levels of arsenic.
What's
in
the hesitation
material.
To knowing what's in our dust, what's in our air? It's a very circular argument to say because there's no standard, we don't want to know.
So let's just say that.
No, I mean, your example of the coal industry. We know what's in coal dust, and it hasn't shut down the industry, but the people living around there have a right to know what's in that dust. And they have the right to know that so they can move, they can invest in air filtration systems. If you don't tell them, if you know or you don't test purposely, and let them know the results of that, you've done a disservice to your community.
So I'd like to use an example.
I don't know how many times we have to go through this and avoid
the
testing.
Okay, let's just say that there wasn't a standard on arsenic, for instance, or cadmium, or chromium. There were no studies to back up what was safe and what was toxic, right? And there was no data, but you wanted me to test if there was arsenic present in our rock. Without data to suggest that it was clean or tolerable levels, the story just kind of gets legs of its own and starts saying, well, you have arsenic, so this must be causing...
People breathing that air have a right to know what's in that air.
And I think you have a right to know if it's a safe level or not safe.
It may not shut you down, but they have a right to know. They have a right to talk with their doctor about health issues they may be having that are related to that.
Absolutely.
They have a right invest... thousands, and I'm speaking from personal experience, in air filtration, so you're not breathing that in your own house.
So I'd like to use an example to kind of
cool it down a little.
Well,
it's very passionate. I can understand the emotion.
We've been talking about this for years.
But we've been talking about it for 3 meetings.
Okay.
Okay. And
fair enough, but
I
don't hear any indication we're moving... any closer.
Well, 2 years ago,
testing.
It was mordenite, and now it's changed to arenite.
Well,
let's test for both.
Let's do this. Let me first open, just let me summarize something that I think would help frame this a little better. back in the 1970s, people were coming down with cancer for no perceptible reason. So there was a lot of concern in the health world. Why are these folks that are seemingly healthy, living healthy lifestyles, getting exercise, doing all the things, keeping their weight down, doing all the things that they needed to do to have robust immune systems, why were they getting cancer? And so they started sampling different things. And they looked at everything. And they looked at, in particular, construction. And they looked at the location of housing. And they found, time and time and time again, in concentrated areas, there was radon gas coming up through the soil into the house where the people lived. And they said, after about 15 years of testing, finally said, holy cow, we've got to do something about this because it's a reality in our communities. So the codes were amended to include radon protection. So the folks in the homes knew and had a protective measure in place to live copacetically in an environment where there was a hazard that had been mitigated successfully through a series of process of digging and finding and realizing and reacting. And that's kind of what we need to do here. You know, before that, there was a ton of speculation about why folks were having so many instances of cancer. Really healthy people were coming down with cancer. There was no hereditary reason for it. There was nothing they could pin it on until they finally looked at radon. Now, in almost every community in every state, there are radon vent requirements in new housing construction. What you'll find in older homes is that hasn't been made. Those hazards still exist. So that's kind of those buyer aware things you need to be thinking about when you buy an older home. Has this been mitigated? Has asbestos been mitigated? We found out that lead-based paint and asbestos were not the greatest things for our health. We've mitigated that in new construction, but there's still millions and millions of old homes that still have that stuff in it that they've either tried to capture in place or they just don't realize. There's homes that are being demolished right and left next to schools and daycares where nobody's watering them down. They're not paying attention to these aspects that could create hazards for their surrounding community. And it is important for us to observe that we are all here together now working on this. It's not the residents, the operators, the regulators all sitting in different rooms coming to our own conclusions. We're trying to do this collectively. And I truly understand the passion and the frustration that has occurred over the years. But again, this is our opportunity to right-size things, to really work hard together to get things done well. It's going to take time. We can't do it immediately, but it's worth the effort. It's worth the time we're putting into this to get this right. Mm-hmm. And I want to commit to everybody, and I think we should commit collectively that working through these types of emotional challenges to get to a point where we have the facts and can make decisions and recommendations is a great place to be, because we'll have the facts and then we can take action.
Okay, about this dust being theoretical, I have to object. I'm Stan Green, and I went up to Yakul Quarry, and I knew what rock I wanted, and I took pictures of it, and I've testified on this before, and this is the absolute truth. So the rock that came down had a lot of dust in it. And, of course, me, having my hard hat on and my vest and everything, I guided the truck back. And I was about from here to you from it, maybe even a little closer. And two loads were dumped, first one load, then the other, and big clouds of dust. Okay, so what happened? I'd never had respiratory problems before in my life, but I got them. And I had to go to a specialist, and I was on an inhaler for more than 2 years. And I suffered over this, and it eventually went away. But if Stordahl gave me free rock, I wouldn't even take it. That stuff for me was dangerous, and I have direct first-hand knowledge of what happened to me, and it was horrible.
I'm sure.
And my daughter was on it too, on an inhaler, and we both recovered enough, but it took time. And it was the dust from that truck dumping that out, and we were close there to it. And that's the absolute truth.
Yeah, I'm not discounting that.
I think, so your
we are in this together. It's nice to see people working and construction happening. That means people are at work and much better than 2008, you know. But there are maybe some simple things that could be mitigating actions that could help restore this balance. If Livingston is done, or a stop order, and it's going to increase at Yakult Mountain Quarry, then there are impacts to the people around that. And it isn't just, that's the way it is, and you guys just suck it up. We have to balance this. So I have two people with asthma in my family, 2 miles away. I worry about them. And my mother-in-law, who was with us for 13 years on our site, died from lung cancer. She didn't smoke. There was no good reason for her to contract that anybody could determine. So it makes me worry. And if there are simple mitigating measures like more watering or covering the trucks or whatever you can think of that don't add a great deal of cost to anyone, why would we not? Especially if we are going to get tests and find out what's in this dust. And just because there aren't standards today doesn't mean that we couldn't take mitigating actions and maybe come up with that together.
Yeah, right now the state and Clark County and the Regional Clean Air Authority and DNR all have emergency mitigation. When a hazard is identified and it is substantial enough, there are measures that can be taken to mitigate.
Well, even if not emergency, even just is the way we're going to operate around here from now on.
We know going forward that the CUPs that we'll do in the future are going to be look quite a bit different than the CUPs that we've had in the past. And from a regulatory perspective, I want to ensure that there's accountability, both from the operator's perspective, but also from the regulator's perspective. Some of the challenges that have been created here have been created by our resourcing ability to. We look at the CUP, and we're going to get into that discussion shortly here, very shortly. Looking at the construct of the CUPs and all the conditions, we didn't do a resourcing analysis. We didn't say, gee, how in the world are we going to track all this stuff? On Yakult Mountain alone, we have something like 100 conditions. That's a huge. I mean, there's a way to manage that, but you've got to have resources to do it, both from the operator's perspective and ours. Finding a way to manage that means we have to look at the way we design CUPs in the future to think about how we're going to mitigate those resourcing challenges, because we want to be successful. We want to be responsive. You know, the mine operators want to be responsive, but they have their responsibilities cross both the responsibility to the environment and the community and to the employees and to the workers and to the industry. It's a fine line that they have to walk. It's kind of easy for me on the regulatory perspective, but I'm not standing on the precipice the way the mine operators are or as you are. You know, I went out, I toured the place. I was not handed a mask or anything to wear. I was not expected to do anything other than wear a high vis. I didn't expect to be impacted by it. I wasn't concerned that I would be. I was more concerned I'd be run over by one of those trucks. But I wasn't. You know, fortunately, they were leading the way safely through the trucks. But it's time for us to really try and dial in the facts on this. And this is what we're here for. So, yes.
Talking about potential solutions, and Vicki mentioned it, how difficult would it be, and it really is, to appease the public, and we know that the dust is, when it's being agitated, it becomes, it covers a wider area. So what is the restraint about covering the loads in the trucks? Because I followed many of them because I go down 117th a lot, and you can see the gravel is definitely above the edges of the truck.
Mm-hmm. So the restriction where I'm required to tarp is anything 5/8 minus and smaller. If we are blowing dust, my dad and I talked about it today at lunch, that maybe we just got to bear down and bite the bullet and tarp if we're blowing. There are products that don't blow dust just because of their natural size, but the crushed products most certainly would be the first ones to escape some of the load.
Well, there's also, I've seen long Facebook conversations about the rocks that are thrown from the trucks and breaking
windshields. Yeah, I try to stay off Facebook.
It's in the same, in the same ballpark.
But if there's a difference between losing your load and breaking somebody's windshield. And I don't want to get into Facebook stuff because the rocks don't escape the load unless we trip our gates. I mean, it can be piled 2 feet above
the sidewalks.
You're saying people are seeing them come off.
Yeah,
people are watching them come off of the trucks, and the concentration of the trucks to vehicles is pretty amazing.
I think the point is tarping has solved both of those issues.
It can't be that. Is it that expensive to take the
trucks? It's time.
The tarps are there. They're on the vehicles.
It's time. And
how much time, though? What, 10 or 15 minutes?
Time for you or time for the truck?
Added onto the truck.
Drivers and, yeah, the haul times and, yeah, sure.
Which results in what?
I think I just got done saying we're considering tarping, and now we're talking about breaking windshields.
It's part of tarping.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, that takes care of both things, as Gary mentioned.
That would be a wonderful first step.
Yeah. I think something that Mitch hit on, using the radon example, you know, problem solving and particularly science involves an iterative process, many steps. You don't just, I mean, it happens often in these small increments. A problem is identified, you figure out how you can assess that, you learn from that exercise, and from that you move forward. I mean, that's how everything has really happened that we know, and the knowledge that we have as a collective body has happened. And so I do think it's shallow to say, and not very helpful, maybe that's a better term, not very helpful, to say that because there's no standards we shouldn't do it. I mean, maybe this is an opportunity for the county, for the citizens and municipalities, and most importantly, for the industry. Mining as an industry, I mean, it's not Patagonia, okay? And I don't mean the location in South America. I mean, like, the company. But socially and environmentally, you know, it's, you guys have a bad rap. I think most people would agree with that. But maybe this is a great opportunity to change that by working as a cooperative to try to tackle some of these issues related to potential toxins or pathogens in the dust plumes. And so I think we need to try to take a step forward and not continue the volley back and forth, which leads to nothing but frustration on both parts.
Well, is that something that we're going to solve here? Is that an EPA direction?
Well, I would say
an air direction.
My sense is that if we were to elicit the help of Department of Ecology or Washington Department of Health, we wouldn't get very far. These are very specialty issues that are going to require people from academia. Okay, if we were to call up Ecology or Health and ask them specifically about these elements, they're going to shrug and they're saying, "Well, let me do a Google Scholar search and see what I can come up with." The same stuff we've come up with. So I think this quickly leaves the arena of state agencies in terms of gathering information. And, of course, that would give the decision makers knowledge.
I'll give you an example. So we were accused of having contaminated material inside the pit without merit. So we went and we pulled the sample to prove the accuser wrong. The results came in and they said, well, you didn't follow the right testing method. Because there's ASTMs for everything, depending on what you're sampling. Mm-hmm. So then it became a matter of, well, now we need to do a different testing method to determine if it is there, because the testing method that you use, you may have missed something. So I've talked to toxicologists, and they said there is no established testing method. So even if you were to go up there independently and pull the sample, hired a lab to test it, that data wouldn't satisfy anybody because, A, where did you pull it from? What was the time of day? And I suggested after a blast, do put some dust collectors out there. And he said, but it won't tell you concentration levels. If it were to be present, it wouldn't tell you that. And there is no set testing method to determine if there's woolly aryanite in the dust particles.
Well, there might be. I mean, believe me, geologists light the volcanic plumes and get the spectral signatures of every chemical element in those plumes. And they do that because of the danger for aircraft, right? We've heard of, we've seen when airports have been shut down in Northern Europe for months, thousands of flights. And, you know, they're using NASA satellites to get those data. And they're published. I know those data. I work with those data.
Specific to what we're talking about today, though.
Well,
I mean,
every element has a spectral signature, and if NASA's flying, which they have constantly circulating over the Earth's surface, hyperspectral satellite imagery at high resolution, my guess is that in an academic setting, that kind of information...
If that information's out there, I'd like to see it, because that would give me some direction.
Well, someone would need to do the analysis. The imagery's there. Somebody has to do the work.
So coordinating that would be quite a piece of work, but I think reaching out to academia could be advantageous in the sense that we might find resources outside the our expense and cost to get that done just by virtue of the fact that they would be able to publish their findings. And
yeah, and NASA just...
It would benefit the industry as a whole.
There was just a workshop at Cascades Volcano Observatory with NASA and people from the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena and others specifically talking about, in this case, volcanic hazards and measuring plumes. So there's a lot out there that's being done, and it's a place to maybe go.
I would also point out as well, reaching out to industry to kind of survey. A lot of our suppliers and contractors do sort of those safety testing to make sure that sites are obviously safe for their employees. So we would be more than happy to help with that as well.
Wow. I'm going to do a little time check here. We had this conversation has evolved. It's very important. If you want to continue it as a group, that's fine. But I'd like to, if you still want to get a compressed, condensed version of this presentation, we can work that out too. Is the audience and the forum interested in finishing this conversation, or would you like to move on? Show of hands for continuing this conversation. Okay, show of hands for moving on. Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, Bo. And I really do want to recognize that we're all at this table together.
Could I make a request from the Ogers? Can I see the data that was pulled from your kitchen counter? See the results?
Actually, it's on public record.
Yeah, we've submitted
it. Those are some of the documents that I mentioned earlier.
Because when I met with, it was a industrial hygienist and a toxicologist, and I said, I'd like to get you the data so you can review it, first of all. And he said, that would get me started of what we're looking for. So I'd like to get that.
It's been submitted, about a month ago.
Can you come visit with me so you can look at it in the hard copy form that we printed it up in?
Yeah.
That would be better, because trying to send it to you electronically is not going to happen. It's going to blur it out pretty bad.
Okay.
All right. Moving on to conditional use permit. Thank you, Dan and
it's kind of,
Susan.
It's printed in print. You really have to see the crisp, high resolution.
So, I'd like to describe our review process in four main stages. It starts with a pre-application conference. The second step is a preliminary review. We also have a final review, and then we get to building permits. So the first step is the pre-application. And pre-application conference was recently held on the proposal to move overburden to an adjacent site for the Yakult quarry. At the pre-application, the applicant submits their pre-application conference request. The applicant and staff meet at that conference to discuss the project and the code requirements. Interested parties can attend, and the applicant receives a pre-application conference report from staff about 7 days after the conference. The preliminary review is the second stage, and I focus this on the process that would be required for conditional use permits. We have several different types of review.
But no more than 90 days prior to submittal, a neighborhood meeting is required and has to be held. The applicant then submits for their conditional use permit, usually that requires that also requires a site plan review and may include other things like wetland or habitat review and other types of reviews. A conditional use permit normally starts out as a type 2A. We have different types of processes from 1 to 4, with 1 being the less complicated and 4 being the more complicated and going to the county council. This starts out as a type 2A, and as a part of that, the first step is an application review for completeness. We make sure that we have everything that we need to review the application. And once it's deemed fully complete, surrounding property owners are sent notice.
How do you define surrounding property owners?
It's different for different types of applications. I think it's 1,260 feet.
Mm-hmm. I believe it's now half a mile in code from the perimeter of the site.
Do you have this a copy of this by any chance? Or did you print this out by any chance?
I didn't print it. I can put it on the website.
Oh,
so everybody can get a copy on the where we have all the other Yakult mine information. So, continuing with the preliminary review, staff reviews the proposal for compliance with the codes, and we write a staff report that usually has detailed information about the code requirements and how the proposal meets those requirements. A public hearing is conducted for Type 3 proposals, and I did include a copy of the conditional use permit code, and as part of that, it allows conditional use permits to be elevated to a type 3 review if determined by the responsible official, which is Mitch. And we had a conversation about it, and at the pre-app for the current Yakult proposal, we did let the applicant know that this would be a type 3 proposal. So what does that mean? I'll get to this a little bit more, but this preliminary review stage is the most important stage to be involved in because it sets all of the, you'll hear a lot about conditions. It sets all the requirements, which is really what conditions are, for what the applicant will have to do in the future. So just a little bit about commenting during the preliminary review and the things that you need to know in case you want to comment on a proposal. So type 3 decisions are made by a hearings examiner. After the notice that I talked about is sent, there's a 15-day comment period. And you can comment within the comment period, but honestly, you can comment all the way up to and including the public hearing. The benefit of commenting during the comment period is that you're guaranteed to have any comments that you've made included and discussed in the staff report. We usually try to include all comments that are made before the staff report is issued and discuss them in the staff report. On a case like this, we've had some before and we've honestly gotten thousands of comments. We'll be developing a way that we'll have to respond to all of those comments, because that in itself will probably be a pretty good job. That's the difference. That's confusing for a lot of people, but that's the difference between the two periods of when you can comment.
So Susan, can you clarify, in the hearing, is there any time limitation for people in attendance to comment?
So we take that kind of on a case-by-case basis. For large cases, if there's a lot of people to testify and so that we won't have a hearing that lasts all night, sometimes we will put testimony times on. It'll kind of depend on how we set it up.
And how we determine, you know, how many people show up, I guess.
So if there was a time limitation or it was going to be a well-attended forum, it would be advantageous for folks to prepare a written copy of their comments in their entirety.
Absolutely.
And then submit that as they're for that. But they only have 3 minutes to talk, but they can submit that document.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion.
The notice that's here, that's the notice to neighbors?
Yes.
Is that the notice that's on? And then there's that happens, then there's a 15-day comment period.
Right.
And then the staff, when the 15 days in the staff report, that's before the hearing. Is that, does that suggest it's 30 or more between notice and hearing?
Right. So the hearing is usually so fully complete, which is the process that we use to decide and make sure that we have everything that we need. Once something is deemed fully complete, a hearing is usually scheduled within about 78 days. So within that time...
It's how many days?
78. Mm-hmm. Within the 78 days... What?
Put it's wrong number.
Within the 78 days, the notice is usually sent within 14 days after fully complete. And I have a graph. I have a table that shows this, and I'll put it on the website as well.
Okay.
So notice is sent within 15 days. After that notice is sent out, there's the 15-day comment period. Those comments are guaranteed to be included and discussed in the staff report. Not that we won't cover topics anyways, but they're guaranteed to be included. We'll, again, have to decide how we do that because I have a feeling we'll get quite a few. So after that 15-day comment period, I don't know, 78 minus 15 plus 14, how many ever days that is left, and then you have your hearing. And during that period is when we're writing the staff report and issuing the staff report and getting all of the exhibits and all of the information that's turned in ready for the hearings examiner to review.
Okay, so the hearing examiner is reviewing the staff report. And the staff report is covering, among other things, the comments that come in during the 15-day period, plus the items that staff thinks are relevant, if, which may or may not be the same stuff, right?
Yes.
The examiner will also have a copy. Every comment that we get will go into the record. Even if you present your comments at the hearing, the examiner will have those, and he deliberates after the hearing before he makes his decision. So he'll have access to every comment that you provide, whether or not it's it's provided enough time for staff to get it into the staff report and recommendation to the examiner.
Okay, and so the staff report contains recommendations to the examiner. And what's his role or her role? The examiner's role?
They make the decision whether to approve it or to deny it.
To accept or not accept the staff report? I mean, that's is that what it comes down to?
Or accept with conditions.
The hearing examiner is an attorney. They're hired independently of staff by the county council, and they review the code, the county code, and the proposal, and decide on all of those points if it meets county code.
Can he add his own conditions too? Because I think that's happened in the past, hasn't it?
Yes. If an issue is raised at the hearing and he wants to write a condition to address that, he's able to do that.
And you have a portion on appeals, right?
I don't have that. Okay. I can talk about it a little bit.
Well, so this might be a good time. So I think what I'm hearing in some of your questions is that you know, where we have an opportunity to ask questions, and after the 15 days, you know, after that, the record closes for public hearing is held, staff report is issued 15 days before the hearing. the staff report is issued exclusively to the hearing examiner?
No.
Or is it issued public?
So anyone who comments prior to the staff report going out will also get a copy of the staff report sent.
Is that staff report appealable?
The staff report is not appealable because it's not a decision, it's only a recommendation. But once the decision is made, so 78 days, we have the hearing. The hearings examiner reviews the entire record, and usually within 92 days, after fully complete, a decision is made. Again, yeah, nice round number, 92 days.
Well, you add them together and you get a magic 150, so.
I'll be honest, in a lot of cases like this, where we have potentially hundreds of exhibits that he has to review, he will likely state at that time that the decision may take more time than that 92 days, which is 14 days after after the hearing. So it's likely that he will make that determination in the mining case.
Pardon me, will the staff report be on the web?
Yes. So it's normal process to post the staff report for any development proposal, and this would be the same.
Can the hearing examiner reopen the record?
Yes. The hearings examiner could look at the room and see how many people are there and decide we're going to take testimony tonight on, for this many people, and we're going to have another hearing on another date because there's so much testimony. He could have an issue that gets raised that it doesn't feel is addressed well enough, and he could ask for additional time to allow information to be submitted. The hearings examiners are really review the entire record before they even get to the hearing, so they know what issues have been raised, they know the comments people have made, they know what studies have been submitted, so they're ready for that process, and they develop questions and have those for staff or for the applicant to ask and to present during the hearing.
How restricted is the hearing examiner by the staff report and the pre-app final report? Is he or her required to stay within that envelope, or do they have some flexibility?
So the examiner needs or is tasked to make a decision how it relates to county code. They don't have to, they are not limited by the recommendations made by county staff. But I'm only going to talk about this a little bit because I think it's an important point. The pre-app that was held, an appeal has come in on that pre-app. And the things that are decided as part of that appeal could affect the process that goes forward. The appeal came in just yesterday, and so we haven't set a hearing or anything yet. We haven't had much time to take a look at it.
So does this timeline pause while that process takes place?
Well, because the only thing that's happened so far is the pre-app, they haven't submitted the preliminary application yet, so we haven't started that at all. We're only at the pre-app process. But as part of the pre-app, some comments went out, and really anything like that from the county is appealable, and that's what's happened.
Is that appealable? Is that appeal on the web?
Not yet.
Oh, it will be, though.
It will be, just like any other.
Okay, thank you.
It's to your appeal, right? Yeah, that's what I said.
Okay. So,
conditional uses have different criteria that they are reviewed under. Any development proposal and the types of requirements that they're met, that they're required to meet. They have different criteria, but conditional uses have some special criteria. And the first is that the responsible official may impose, in addition to regulations and standards expressly specified in this title, other conditions found necessary to protect the interests of the surrounding properties or neighborhood or the county as a whole. In the code, which you can get a copy of, there's a list of issues. A lot of them may not apply to a mining operation, but some of them that do relate to setbacks, hours of operation, access, and other issues that we've talked about today. It's a list that says it includes but is not limited to. So, like I said, the examiner is looking at the criteria in the code, comparing the proposal to those criteria. So these criteria are pretty important.
Is the examiner the responsible official in this paragraph?
Say that one more time.
Who is the I'll rephrase it. Who is the responsible official referenced there? Is that Mitch?
So it's kind of an interesting concept, but the responsible official, because the hearings examiner is making that decision, the responsible official in this case is referring to the examiner. So sure. Responsible official is a term that is used for decisions, and it can be staff in some situations, it can be Mitch in some situations, and it can be the examiner.
In this context,
it's the examiner.
Now, I'm on the side of the staff report, typically.
Okay.
That's our obligation.
Okay, so a second criteria that's important in conditional use permit review in our code states the responsible official must find that the establishment, maintenance, or operation of use applied for will not be significantly detrimental to the health, safety, or general welfare of persons residing or working in the neighborhood of the proposed use, or be detrimental or injurious to the property and improvements in the neighborhood or to the general welfare of the county. So again, testimony that you provide and your involvement in the process should relate to the requirements. These are not the only ones, but these are two of the major points in a conditional use permit. I encourage, if you're interested in being part of the process, I encourage you to look at the entire conditional use permit section and read through that and answer questions.
And surface mining overlay is another section of the code that is specific to mining, and so that is more hard and fast code specifics as to what applies to mines and what doesn't. So that the surface mining overlay in conjunction with the condition use chapter are what staff and the examiner will primarily base the decision on.
Is the neighborhood of, it says persons residing working in the neighborhood of the proposed use, is that still that half mile, or is that anybody in a larger geographic area?
It's not specific. The notice and that criteria really don't have anything to do with it.
So it's not a half mile. I mean,
well, the notice goes out per the prescriptive requirements of the half mile, but the testimony can come from.
And the impacts could be farther than half a mile.
Yes.
Okay, so Mitch brought up a good point, and I should have the appeal language in there. Once a decision is made, there are 14 days in the appeal period, and anyone who is a party of record, meaning you've made some sort of comment or given us your name and mailing address, and it does have to be a mailing address, can be or is a party of record, and any party of record can appeal a decision. So that could be the applicant or that could be any other interested party that became a party of record.
Is there a time frame on that, on an appeal?
14 days. It has to be received in our permit center, and our permit center closes at 3 p.m.
Is that 14 days from the date the decision is published, or?
Mail.
Okay.
Yeah. We will likely, yes, put this on, well, just like any other development proposal, we put decisions on the web as well.
And is that appeal, does it have a prescribed fee with it for?
It does.
$1,300 plus the maintenance.
Yes, it's just about, yeah, I think it's $1,166 plus $94. And is there an engineering fee portion of that?
I think it depends on whether those engineering issues involved.
Yeah. We can get you that information.
I think I've seen a schedule of that somewhere.
I'm just wondering about an appeal of a type 3 of a hearing examiner decision goes to Superior Court. So actually, I'm not sure how that, those fees would be.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the fees to Superior Court would be. Typical appeal that we would appeal of a lower decision to an examiner decision.
Susan?
Yes.
Excuse me, I have a quick question. So once, if there's an objection on form of an appeal, do the parties sit down with the county on each side to try to have a resolution meeting to try to keep this from going to litigation, to see if something can be worked out?
So that's a great question. And I think that in some cases, the court can decide that facilitated mediation is a possibility, but that would be up to the court.
Thanks.
Okay.
What's the role of the county counselors in this whole process once the decision's been made by the...
The role in development of the county counselors is they have set the laws and the ordinances that any development has to meet. But once those are set, and once an application comes in, there's a term called vesting. And once something is determined to be fully complete, and in some cases it can be somewhat, it can be the submittal of the pre-application conference, getting really technical, but that the term vesting applies to the laws that are in place when one of those two dates happens, and that development proposal has to be reviewed under those laws. And so once an application is vested, then the application is reviewed, and the appeal goes to the court, and the county council is actually not directly involved.
Is the Planning Commission involved at all?
No.
Okay.
Just a decision by the hearing examiner.
Is the hearing examiner selected on just a rotation, or is there a credentials kind of vetting?
So because they're independent contractors, there was a request for proposals done at this point several years ago, and we do a request for proposals. We don't have a set schedule, but both of these examiners have been with the county for quite some time. Their contracts have been renewed, but the initial process was them responding to a request for proposals.
How do you choose between the two?
You know, I wasn't involved with that. They interviewed different people. And
no, I mean for a particular application.
So the examiners generally keep, not always, sometimes they switch, but the examiners generally, one of them does the first hearing, which is the second Thursday of the month, and one of them generally does the fourth Thursday of the month. Usually it's just set by... when the application is submitted and when it becomes fully complete. And that 78 days, we don't always hit exactly 78 days, but we try to hit around 78 days and set the hearing.
Not to be conspiratorial, but so the applicant can kind of take a shot at picking who's going to hear it.
Yeah.
zero.
Oh my.
Just checking. Not to give Bo any ideas.
Yeah, right. I have to just make a mention that the hearing examiners that you have are well-trained attorneys who have done a remarkable job in learning Clark County Code and really diving into the things. And they have a habit of thinking of holding us accountable, which is the best case scenario from our perspective there. If they have questions, we are the first to hear.
I have a question. So the whole process goes through, and an example would be you've got CUP up on Livingston Quarry, and it's been done, and the codes are the codes. What about opening it back up, the submission or application for review? And then is that possible? And if it is possible, are you only able to open it to one commission? Example would be Charters.
So, if there is a provision in the conditional use code that a conditional use permit can be revoked,
I'm not saying revoked, because it would be the actual CUP holder that it actually is acting to open it back up.
So, unless the operator were to propose something new, there wouldn't be a reason to open up the approval.
Well, the wording is, Tower will fund and manage the submission of an application for review of the Livingston Quarry CUP. Application will be limited to the question of whether trips allowed under the Livingston Mount Quarry CUP may be utilized for the other quarry. So, my question is, could the Yakult Quarry want to open up? I mean, Stordahl can turn around and say, gosh, I would like to increase my number. So that's something that can start to happen throughout the county if they're doing it on Livingston.
So the process that we would use for deciding if a specific condition was not met would be that revocation process.
And not met would mean they're not met.
Meaning that they're not doing whatever that condition sets out. So,
I think her question was, numbers.
Opening up another CUP for expanded rights, not a condition that wasn't being met, but would like to have.
They like to add more trackers.
Yeah.
Yeah, they can apply for that. And I apologize if I'm misunderstanding.
Okay, yeah,
they can apply for more trackers.
Okay. And then it would only be specific for just the truck trips, or do you open up the CUP for everything to be looked at?
Oh, I question.
Can you limit?
So,
I think we probably have to look at the condition that opened that up and see what it referred to.
That's not an increase in truck trips, though. It's a determination to decide if the truck trips that are allowed under this CUP can exit this gate.
Yes.
It's not an increase in load. It's determining, was the examiner's decision based on restricting loads coming from this CUP to come out of this gate and this CUP to come out of that gate, or does it really not matter which gate they come out of because it's the same impact of the county road system? That's the determination that is being sought.
Right, they're looking to do 470 truck trips, and the population has tripled since the CUP went in. So my question is, I guess my next one is, can the citizens come in and say, actually, we would like a change? And nobody can answer that question.
Well,
no, can you?
And we, to specifically answer this, we may need to, and I don't want to get into answering questions like that we may even need our legal counsel to weigh in on.
We
review the code. Development proposals, and the development proposal would be from the applicant. The property owner to do something on their property. So the neighbors would have to make the argument that the operator was not complying with the requirements in their conditional use permit to be able to go through the revocation process, And the revocation process doesn't mean that there wouldn't possibly be, I don't want to say this. The revocation process is the only process that I know of that would handle something like that from the neighbors. Okay. The neighbors can't really propose a change to someone else's property. Okay. In any case.
I like your analogy. I think to your specific analogy, so the environmental conditions, circumstances around change. A lot of new housing was developed that wasn't contemplated at the time the decision was made. Mm-hmm. And so with the addition of the new housing and looking how the impacts on that truck traffic or the mine operations or whatever the case may be are now being felt by a group of people, residences that weren't party or didn't have an opportunity to be present or be considered in that initial CUP, there could be an opportunity for a petition to reopen or revisit that decision without necessarily revoking it and having to start the whole process anew. But I think there's a reasonable solution in the midst of that somewhere, but Susan's point, I think we need to get our legal counsel involved and get everybody the same information.
I have one more question, and thank you for answering. So based on what you just said, would that throw that into a Type 3 process, or would that stay in Type 2A if they opened it back up?
So it says that it's a 2A, but under the same section that says that NIC has the right to elevate it to a Type 3, that would still be a possibility.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah. And any 2A can be requested to be a Type 3 by, I think it says, any interested party as well.
Thank
you. Yeah. Kind of an interesting proposition, particularly with mine, where the CUP could be locking you in for, 75 years with no obvious appeal avenue for change in technology and circumstance. And
I mean, that's a great point. So think about mining technology. Think about geographic technology, geologic technology. What do we have now that helps us determine the volumetric aspects of the mine product? And how much is there, and how long it will take to successfully complete that operation?
Or best practices. I mean, you know, technology can change pretty darn fast, and there could be technology available that makes the whole procedure better for the community, but it's not been mandated in the original CUP. And what I'm hearing is there's no obvious avenue for the public to get in and say, hey, these changes would be good for all of us.
Well, the examiner at Livingston, the examiner did have a condition that after at a certain point in the development of that quarry, I think it was phase 4, that there would be a new hearing to see how the conditions of approval were going. So the examiner can open that door for such
reviews. But environmental changes, best management practices, that's a ever-changing and evolving standard from the regulatory agencies. I think that a lot of times we confuse Clark County with DOE, DNR, Southwest Clean Air, people that are responsible for updating and evolving those standards, environmental standards, and then impose that on the operator. That's not something that Clark County is necessarily on top of because they're not the regulatory agency of those particular issues, air, water. They have their code, but as far as evolving to new technology, that's something that every regulatory authority does.
Yeah,
we get updates to our Southwest Stormwater Pollution Prevention Plan every couple of years.
Yeah, I look at the noise regulation. You know, as it relates to measurement, and it's set at a standard that was established somewhere back in the 80s, I think, the best that I can tell. But the specific requirements for noise measurement are structured within what we knew at the time that measurement was created. I used to you know, I worked in an industry in seismograph. We looked for oil. At the time in the 70s, we were using vibroseismic, which was hydraulic compression of the earth, you know, rapidly, to create vibration so we could read the seismic records to determine what was underneath us. Mm-hmm. Back in the 40s, when they first decided that it was easier to do seismology than doing wildcat wells to figure out if there was something down below, they used dynamite. And they'd drill holes in the ground, drop 40 pounds of TNT, and sit back, you know, blow holes in the ground to test to determine that. But the record was really ugly. Using a more measured, more reliable, and more consistent method of looking for oil yielded a lot less impacts on the surface. You weren't blowing holes anymore. You were just creating kind of a rut in the ground that was restored with grass after you'd gone by. When you look at this type of changes in our environment and technology that we're seeing, it's reasonable to assume that when we have something that has the long-range impact and duration of mining, surface mining, that it's reasonable to reopen those and revisit those along the way periodically to look at those things and say, is there a better way to do something?
Well, to Jan's point about Livingston, could we suggest that as you prepare your report for the recommendations for the examiner, that a sunset provision, if you will, recommendation like that goes into it, so that it's not at all unreasonable to say, you know, these things need to be reviewed. And you know, not to drive them crazy, you don't want to do it every 6 months or any silly thing like that, but.
Typically our recommendations are based in code, established code, and so we have to err on the side of the council's direction and adoption of the codes and the regulations that go along with that. If we suggest something outside of it, that has to be vetted through them first. So normally if you were to say, having this conversation as an example, we decide that looking at a 75-year proposal for a mining operation, is this something we would like to add a level of staff review that we don't currently have? And we look at longevity of operation versus just the physical aspects or the geographic aspects or the impacts, the immediate environmental impacts. Those are things that we have to go through a process to adopt, but once they're adopted, then it has a higher probability of becoming part of our recommendation because we get to consider that aspect.
If I can have one more thing, and I'm not an attorney on this by any stretch of imagination, but my understanding is that conditional uses, because they are a little bit subjective, I mean, you looked at the wording in that code, that there's also case law that pertains to how often you can open up a conditional use permit. It's like, I think they call it like taking another bite of the apple. So the examiners, they think, well, they are first in, you know, land use law. And so it could be that the examiner can't say, you know, okay, we're going to open this up and start brand new every so often. I think generally they tend to be rather measured in what they can do because of case law. So again, I'm not a lawyer, but I think we should be careful that we don't give the impression that the examiner can do whatever he wants in regards to subsequent reviews. I think, you know, they have a much better idea of what is customary under the case law and constitution and all that.
Are there some CFPs that are 75 years in duration?
Not to my knowledge. They just continue as long as the use that they authorize is necessary.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it could be.
It could be you can't operate a nuclear plant for longer than 20 years without getting a new license.
You could certainly see, this is a very interesting conversation, I think, that's going around the room. And you could, given the duration, the longevity of a mining operation, conditions change. I mean, a number of people have alluded to that. So it would seem to me that there's extenuating circumstances that could rise that would create a compelling case, right? I mean, I think using the Yakult Mountain Quarry as an example, I think many of the people in this room lived more or less in harmony, using very loose language, up to about 3 years ago. And that's when things really got ratcheted up. And I think that's why so many of us are here. And I would love to look at the data, what's happened at the mine productivity. Or Bo's alluded to the fact that there's been some clear-cut logging, which certainly hasn't helped a bit. So in terms of noise, let's just say, for one element. But I'm very intrigued by your comment, Mitch, of that there may be a process to petition or open up at least some aspect of some element of a current conditional use permit. And so if we could incorporate that process, the mechanism for doing so, into our next forum, I think that'd be a wonderful agenda. Item to have on our agenda.
I've already got a note here to run it by our legal counsel, and I think I'd rather have an expert be here to have those conversations and to guide that. As
sure.
As myself, I'm like Jan, not an attorney.
Yeah.
Happily so.
So don't say that to your boss.
We have run 2 hours.
Yeah.
This has been a wonderful conversation. I know that there was another portion of this.
This is really quick because, like I said, the preliminary review process is the process that I think it is the most important to be involved in. But just for your knowledge, there is a final review process. There is detailed engineering review and site plan, final site plan review. During that time, the building permit process can also occur with site plan reviews. During this time, not all, but some of the conditions, those requirements that are made as part of the preliminary decision, are reviewed to ensure that those conditions are met. Just a little bit on the building permit, which may or may not be applicable for any proposal that would come forward, but we have plans examiners that review building plans for compliance with the building safety codes. The permit technicians help issue those permits, and once the permits are issued, that's when building construction can occur. But site work can occur after the final review.
Right. And in the case of Yakko, right, there was, and Bo mentioned this previously, is that they had to do some road improvements. They had to help with the right-of-way improvements and reinforcement, provide money, and so forth. I mean, that was all part of that process. Now, I would point out, by the time we get the final approval, the investment by the applicant is extreme. And there's still a possibility that they won't get it. So,
since it says questions, I have one. Somewhere back in the last 2 hours, Mitch, you mentioned something to the effect that there's not a step for resourcing the compliance monitoring. Are you suggesting another step would be added to the CUP process to include that?
All right, this is going to be a dicey answer. First, the real step that we need to take is we need to resource it. We're obligated to do that the way it's currently structured, and we haven't done that. So we've hired another code enforcement officer who's going to replace the Ben Jonah that we had doing the compliance work and monitoring and working with the operators to be as responsive as possible to everybody that has a dog in the hunt, so to speak, and also focus on the community outreach and make sure that the aspects of the agreement and the operations that involve the community, like a 5-member board and so forth. I mean, those things really are not things the county can do, but we can help work with the involved parties and to get those things constructed so there is that more robust and more immediate level of communication when an issue arises. If a truck goes by and rocks are falling off and you call the quarry operator and they can identify the truck by the number that you've reported, they may even be able to reach out to them by on the road and say, hey, pull over, get the tarp on that thing. You're losing rock. You know, that type of responsiveness can't be managed by us, even if we have an individual involved in that process, but it can be fostered by us and supported by us in the sense that we've opened that communication line for that more immediate response when we're 2 hours away from the site otherwise. So the other aspect, to answer your question, is a resourcing analysis is a fundamental part of doing a project scoping, is figuring out, okay, once you know what you want to build, what's it going to take to do it? And who are you going to keep in place to make sure that what you built continues to operate the way it's supposed to operate? In spite of our resourcing challenges, once the CUP is developed, once it is issued and approved, nothing that the county does or doesn't do alleviates the responsibility of the CUP holder of complying with every aspect of those conditions. Nothing. There is nothing you can look at and say, this condition is no longer applicable because the county's not out here checking. That's not the case. It's the same with building permits that we issue. Whether we, in our plan reviews, catch every aspect or every correction that needs to be made, or whether we, during an inspection, observe a violation that may exist or not observe, nothing alleviates the responsibility of the permit holder from building that structure in accordance with the codes and the approved engineer's design. Nothing. So we are reliant on the industry to a great extent to be diligent about their responsibility to operate under the rules and laws that regulate their permits.
Then it becomes a complaint-driven process, right? That the community has to file a complaint and go through channels. So it's reactive instead of proactive, where you've got inspectors doing surprise audits and
that's the worst way to manage it, truly.
The complaint driven?
Yeah.
Oh, I agree.
From my perspective, having robust mechanisms, it's like in building permits, we have required inspections. Mm-hmm. Those are required inspections. If we did the same thing in the CUP environment, we structured that where we told the operators of the surface mining or constructors of the subdivision, whatever the case may be, if it were a development agreement or a conditional use permit or something that had conditions of operation attached to it, that there was a monitoring component and a verification component. The monitoring component is typically going to be the responsibility of the operator. The verification component is going to be the responsibility of the jurisdiction. But making sure we resource that properly. So when we construct the CUPs, we construct the development agreements, we have built ourselves into the process in a reasonable way, but also given ourselves the resources to do that. So we need to do a needs assessment and say our operational needs include servicing 2,000 CUPs simultaneously.
Well, how about setting up a process with today's technology, blasting records, truck trips, all the things that you have conditions on, that there's reporting made available to the public on that, to where it's not some big, black box secret that you can't easily get to.
So the whole idea is to have those reports published online for each mine operation on the Surface Mining Advisory Committee website.
I would say yes. So
that's the intent here, is to get to the point where we're taking the reports, we're collecting the reports, they're producing the reports, we're publishing the reports. Everybody gets to see what's going on.
So you're auditing the reports.
Will that be part of the process?
So the code enforcement officer's job is going to be monitoring and collecting those reports. Mm-hmm.
To some extent, what you're this conversation harkens back to earlier times. I looked at the final decision, Yakko Mountain Quarry, CPZ 2002, and it lists these things. A 5-member neighborhood advisory group should be established to review quarry operations, effectiveness of mitigation measures, monitoring results, and provide an open channel of communication for the residents of the area and provide possible solutions to any problems. This group shall meet a minimum of once each year for the first 5 years and a minimum of every 2 years thereafter determined by the neighborhood advisory group. See Q6, page 67. This has happened. Second, the operator performs compliance monitoring of mining noise levels, develops a groundwater monitoring plan and a blasting program in years 2, 4, and 6, and intervals thereafter determined by the neighborhood advisory group. If the quarry is not in compliance, quarry operations shall be immediately modified or further mitigation measures implemented to bring it into compliance. Details should be worked out prior to the final site approval. Q7, page 67. 3. All neighbors within 1 mile of the quarry boundary, the Neighborhood Advisory Group, Clark County, and the Department of Natural Resources shall be provided with a copy of the regular monitoring results and any follow-up compliance monitoring showing how the quarry is performing and an invitation to respond to concerns. Has that happened? So did these things stick to the wall? Did these things fall off?
So as far as I can answer that, there was an advisory group of the neighborhood when it started, and it wasn't set by us, the operator, set by the property owner. There was a group of about five people from the neighborhood. They got together occasionally. Reports were submitted to them. I can provide names to you if you'd like, but that group dissolved because they got tired of meeting with each other, and there wasn't issues that came up at the meeting. So everybody said, can we agree we can just stop meeting on this?
So we should rejuvenate that. This is an opportunity.
And we talked about doing that, and I think that's why we're here. We talked about getting a... I would like a neighborhood group. I'd like a small group. I'd like a representative of the neighborhood, myself, a member from industry, to get together and talk about real things and solve real problems.
Specific non-operation.
Yeah.
That's, you know, the areas are first name.
Yeah. I'm still...
It's not something we can create for you. I mean, this, again, you have to reconstitute it yourself.
But we can ask whether there's been monitoring of the noise levels, groundwater monitoring program, and blasting programs. And it seems like, you know, perhaps the problem is the advisory group fell off the face of the earth, and maybe there's no time better than to reinitiate that. I mean, it seems like what a great mechanism to get these things surfaced, to increase awareness, and to work together on these issues that we've...
Yeah, I'd have to disagree that it should be a small group, though, because you get one or two people trying to represent everybody, it's not going to work.
Well, this has five members of the neighborhood, so, you know, yeah. It's...
I think it needs to be open to the public like this.
Well, but all that I'm saying is I think we'd be a lot better off if we had a five-member neighborhood advisory in addition to this, and people who were really tracking the quarry operations, the effectiveness of mitigation measures, monitoring results, and become a clearinghouse to information for the broader community. I'm not in argument with you one bit, Gary, but I think that this would be a good thing, as are the forums. Yeah. And we should.
I just think we would need to be careful that the previous committee may have died just due to the makeup of the people on that committee.
Clear. Yeah, no, the devil's in the details.
Yeah.
Right?
So I think the concept is good. I think we need to make it work somehow, launching from what we're doing here.
Yeah, it would have been, you know, wonderful to have members of that group actually join us here.
Yeah, where are they?
How things are going, right? I mean, that would have been nice, but as we went through the CUP requirements, as we looked at all the complaints and concerns we were getting, so I reviewed those, and I said, wow, it seems like there was a lot of opportunity in here for engagement and problem resolution much quicker than a complaint-based resolution, which was really frustrating for us because we couldn't possibly get out there and witness the violation and do anything meaningful with our enforcement process. Our enforcement process is very cumbersome. I'm working on changing that as well, but for the time being, in this day-to-day operational environment of the mine and the residence and living environment, having a very immediate, very connected way of communicating about those issues is, I think, a great thing to do. I mean, it takes work off our hands if you can solve issues amongst yourselves.
I don't want to beat a dead horse, but having a strong reporting requirement on every aspect of the CUP, I think, would be the most effective thing you could do. The operator basically signs, you know, an affidavit, like it's like SOX compliance for a corporation. You're supplying the required information at the required time, and you're signing on the bottom line that it's accurate, true and accurate.
Well, the language is largely here. The question is the final, maybe Susan or Jan, the final decision, Yakult Mountain Quarry, it's a document from the county, is that essentially the record of decision, and is it a lawfully binding document?
Yeah. In this application, there was the initial examiner's report, then it went to the board, and the examiner denied the rezone, but a lot of the conditions were instituted by staff, and then the examiner took most of them, and the examiner had a list of conditions, but still denied the rezone. It got appealed to the Board of County Commissioners at that time because they were the appeal authority at the time. The board overturned the rezone and tweaked the conditions a little bit. And I have to say that there are some very minor tweaks in the final decision that aren't reflected in this, but they're very minor. So then it got appealed to Superior Court, and Superior Court upheld the board's approval, essentially. And so these conditions are what is ruling the quarry at this time.
Right, so there was a question earlier, and Susan, I think you did a great job presenting, so thank you. But I just for clarification, because I think Dick asked the question, land examiner, I think that's the proper name, if it's not, you know who I mean, I think. But that person, it was our understanding, is the final decision maker. But what we're hearing now is the commissioners, or now would be the council, can actually override the land examiner's decision. And so really, the ultimate decision maker is either a judge or the council.
So the council used to be involved in the appeal process. They aren't anymore.
Got it. Okay.
So that has changed.
Okay.
So yes, the court could be the final decision maker if it's appealed.
Okay. So what can we do to move forward on these three things that already are part of the rod?
As far as it pertains to a more robust reporting requirement, the framework's already there. Having a vehicle to correlate the reports, put them on the website for everybody to see them, is something for us to do. And we hire a code enforcement officer who I'm going to train, and you will meet at our next meeting, who is going to be joining us at these meetings, but also hopefully joining at those neighborhood group meetings with the operators to be there as a voice representing us, the regulator, but at the same time bringing information back to us to help us and aid us in our decision making and in the construct of future CUPs. Ultimately, we want things to work well. Our only objective is to ensure that we have given everybody fair opportunity and fair representation and fair responsiveness. And we've been as fair as we can, and without prejudice, without bias. And we're getting really, really good at what we're doing here. And I don't want to in any way lose the value of this environment. So for the immediate future, I see these occurring continuously for a long, long time. So there's just no need for them. That may outlive me. unless there's any other questions.
Is that sort of the survey results? Are they to be released to the public or the press?
Yes, so these are already on the website. Marilyn Lee has already published them on the website.
Okay.
If you go to Clark.
There we go.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
One other question. You handed out this origin sources of the conditions of approval, all nicely color-coded and everything. Is this the complete set of CUPs for the Yakult Mountain Quarry?
It's the list of conditions. I should probably update make the minor changes that were made. When I was looking at this judgment, it said appended conditions of approval, and I believe that all the minor conditions that the board
county commissioners at the time made to it, were integrated into it, but they were not. So what we need to do is get a new clean copy of that. That would
So how do you read this if there's no CUP or SMO or M out to the side of it? It was in the original hearing examiner report, but it was dropped.
These conditions are...
Oh, these are all...
These are all currently in effect. Again, it's a couple of very, very minor changes.
Ask Jan to look at the nature of the different kinds of conditions, which ones were monitoring and required some...
Oh, okay, I see. So these are...
Yeah, it's just an informational document.
Oh, I mean, it's helpful.
Oh, yeah, we've been wanting this since our first meeting, so now we've got something.
But Jan, does this exist?
We'll also post the decision that Jan's talking about that has the weeks that we're going to give you a final
document. Yeah.
We will also post the CUP process presentation online, but as a housekeeping measure, we did have a request to... we had talked about adding the field process. Is that something that you wouldn't mind terribly if we added, even though we didn't discuss it, to the presentation? So we can post this online. It's inclusive of that appeal process.
That would be good if it was included.
Okay, we'd like to.
Yeah. Sure.
Their consensus.
Okay. Some people can be here. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Okay, I was curious. Does this document exist in digital format? Oh, it's just a scale. It looks like an old document that's been scanned.
There's an old TIF. The original judgment that we got was in the TIF.
Yeah.
So I did OCR on it today, and the computer tried to decide what all of the words were, and it's not the best copy, so there's quite a few misspellings and things like that in there. So we'll either have somebody... We'll probably have somebody post it out and try to make changes, but still put on there that it's not the original decision.
Yeah, because I think this is incredibly useful, but I could see where it might be nice to reshuffle some of the things within a document, which would be easy to do if it were in an ethical electronic format. But I appreciate just having it, so thank you.
Well, any last words? Okay, but anyone else? Thank you all for coming.
You understand about trees and planet such little bit topsoil, great soil. You know about for a zoo or a play or even something else. It's at the little waste.
Good presentation.
My suggestion is you can better support this, but I was going to get this to Marie. I would suggest and her.
Okay.
Talk to him.
He's a
graduate force resources.
Okay.
He's very good.
Okay.
I know these people. They're right at Rush.
Okay.
Or find something that can write a report. I talk to Marie on the phone. That shows that the plan is flawed. And the things, drawings of these.
I can write that report. I can believe it.
Because I don't have the time right
here. Yeah, I know. That's a trick, right? It's the time.
Right.
So, that's the university.
Yeah. Your contact
emails came out.
Good discussion, guys. Poland, troops, Curtis, France, Sandbag, it's big time. We saw that.
Okay. They really tried to get the decision.